The Vet Tech Cafe is a podcast centered around veterinary technicians and nurses. We strive to discuss current issues facing our profession and give our colleagues a voice and a medium to enter into these discussions. Our guests are experts in the veterinary field that we hope can help our listeners work towards dealing with these issues, as well as coming up with solutions that can lead to change. If you have a question or a comment for us, please contact us at vettechcafe@gmail.com. And now, here are Dave, Jeff, and another amazing guest on the Vet Tech Cafe.
Hello, everybody. Thanks for stopping by the Vet Tech Cafe today. We hope you're having a great week. Dave, what's going on in your world? What's happening down there?
First week of classes. Got a couple new classes that I'm teaching, so it's a little bit hectic at this point. Having to reach back into the depths of my mind to remember some of the stuff that I forgot about since high school and college, but it's working well. And we are in winter here in North Carolina, and it is not winter at all. It was about 70-ish degrees today, so I'm loving it. This is great.
Yeah, it's mid-January, so even here in New England, Saturday and Sunday, both here in Rhode Island and at Tufts in Grafton, Massachusetts, it was 70 degrees.
Wow.
Yeah. And then the next day, it was like 40 degrees and it actually felt cold again, but still, I mean, barely a snowflake to be found.
Have you had any snow up there yet?
We've had probably, where I'm at in Rhode Island, we've had probably a total of maybe 5 inches. Dang. So far this season. And, you know, in Grafton at the school, I mean, if we get 2 inches, they might get, you know, 8 to 10 or 12. Yeah, so yeah, they get quite a bit more. But here we've really just had slush and ice. Mm. And it's just been kind of a downer. And this is my last winter in New England for a little while. So,
oh yeah, because you guys are, you know, you're heading back to California. Is that the deal?
Yeah, in the fall. So I kind of wanted like to go out with a bang, but it's still mid-January. It's still kind of early. Hopefully it'll ramp up.
You still got a couple months for snow to
get. I'm probably the only person in New England that wants it to get crazy, but I'm hoping. So it's a busy time of the year in our profession.
Yes, it is.
You know, there's a lot of people that we're going to be talking to over the next couple of months that we're trying to schedule, and a lot of them were headed down to VMX this weekend for the show down in Orlando. It's getting into conference season.
Yeah, we've had to adjust our interview schedule based on VMX, and actually our guest today is going to VMX. I think she's leaving tomorrow, but we'll talk to her about that. But yeah, it's getting to be that busy time of conference season.
Yeah, there's VMX this weekend. I know, you know, I'm from the West Coast, Western States, Vegas is a big one. I think is in like mid-February.
Yeah. And I went to that one year.
Yeah, I have. I'm from Southern California, and I still have not been to that.
It's a lot of fun.
I bet. I did go to VMX. I think it was 2 years ago, and that was the first kind of national but more generalized conference. And I was blown away at how big it was and how much they had going on. Yep. And yeah, it was quite the show. So those of you listening, if you haven't been to something like that out there, definitely make it a priority to go or work with your practice managers or your bosses and see if they can swing it to help you get there. Because not only the learning and the quality of the CE programs and all of that, but the networking that you get to do, the exhibit halls, all that stuff.
Yeah,
it's a time for sure. One thing, Dave, actually, you sent this to me today that is kind of making its rounds. And this was published in DVM 360,
yes.
This article on the title is The Myth of Compassion Fatigue in Veterinary Medicine. And, you know, one thing I do want to point out is that the date of this article is from January 2017.
Right, it was a couple years ago. But I saw it posted on somebody's wall, and I said, oh, I'm going to check out this thing because this kind of ties into what we talk about.
Yeah, this kind of is definitely a running theme with the show and, you know, mental health and just all that kind of in general. But this was a little bit of a contrarian point of view.
She was talking about this veterinarian. She was talking about how she doesn't believe in compassion fatigue, where she was saying that when you get that burnt out feeling and you're exhausted and you're tired, that's more just, it can be either ethical fatigue instead of compassion fatigue, where you're torn between what test you want to do and how much money you want to charge the owners. And she mentioned that a lot of what we interpret as compassion fatigue is just being overtired, which is a horrible way to just oversimplify exactly what's going on. And as I was reading through this, it seems like she doesn't believe in compassion fatigue because she's never experienced it. Well, it took me a long time to experience compassion fatigue. And then once I did actually experience it, I was like, oh, this is actually a real thing. And to be able to just sit there and say that it's not a real thing just because you haven't experienced it is, I don't even understand the logic behind that, because, you know, I haven't experienced a lot of things, but I still believe they exist. like burnout. It was a long time before I experienced burnout, but I saw it happen every day.
Right.
And, and to just say that it's not a thing is just kind of crazy.
Yeah. And one of the points that she makes is, and it's one of the statements that's kind of like outlined in bold embedded in the article is, quote, "I am the source of my own compassion, therefore it will never run out." Right. I feel like, you know, while that's a wonderful idea, I feel like everybody at some point will run out, and maybe she just hasn't run out yet.
Yeah, I wonder how far into her career this person is. I don't remember exactly how long it said that they were in practice.
I don't know if it did say.
Yeah,
and you know, even if this is somebody that's been practicing 30 years and is close to retirement, if they've made it that far, then fantastic.
Yeah,
there probably are people that maybe can compartmentalize or distance or, you know, and actually have a very long run in this field and maybe never actually get to that point. But I think to dismiss or to say, you know, well, you know, just changing your perspective,
right,
you know, change your perception. I just don't think for a lot of people that deal with this all the time, I just don't think that's the reality that they live in. And it's tough. And to be fair, like this veterinarian owns a hospice service.
Right.
I mean, so this is somebody that probably deals with a lot of end of life stuff.
Right.
And so, I mean, and she references the ER work that she's done. So I feel like she actually has been probably in a lot of really draining and demanding situations.
I'm sure,
That could get the best of anybody. So more power to her for being able to avoid this. But, you know, you wonder, is having that mentality actually a result of already experiencing compassion fatigue?
Maybe the fact that she uses so much compassion in her everyday job that she's, I don't want to say she's become numb to it, but she's been able to find ways to deal with it. Because, you know, if I worked in hospice, I don't think I would have a hard time doing that.
Right. I know. I completely agree. And one other thing I do want to point out, because we have referenced this term in a few different episodes, and she does say in here, according to the Oxford English Dictionary, compassion fatigue is defined as an indifference to charitable appeals on behalf of those who are suffering, experienced as a result of the frequency or number of those appeals. And so, you know, I do think that every individual is going to have a finite amount of compassion. And then when they get to the end of that tank, as she says, like, how do you deal with that? And for some people, sure, like, you can do things that bring you joy or kind of reset you or recenter you. And for some people, it's just not that simple.
Right, right.
And I'm afraid she's dismissing a large swath of our profession.
Well, and I mean, how many veterinarians and veterinary technicians are there in the world? I'm sure not all of us experience compassion fatigue. If that was the case,
the
profession would dwindle to nothing. There's got to be people out there
right.
that don't experience it. But then to also take that and look at the other side of that and say, well, I don't believe it exists, that almost detrimental to the field.
Right. Anyway, it's a really, really interesting article. And actually, I think it's the first that at least I can recall reading that's kind of had a contrary or, you know, a point of view from the other side. And it was a little bit eye-opening. And I would be very curious to know, you know, here we are 2 years later, almost to the day of when this was published, if she looks at it any differently or whether or not for her, or if she knows anybody in the profession, whether that works for her or colleagues that have experienced this.
Yeah.
The
landscape of the veterinary field has changed a lot in the last couple of years.
Yeah, for sure.
Just on this topic. So I wonder if her ideas and thoughts have changed since then.
Yeah, for sure. Really, really interesting stuff either way. So what do you think? Should we introduce our guest?
Yeah, we should bring out our guest because I think that in the job that she does, I would imagine she has to use a lot of compassion because she's not working in, well, I guess at some point she does work in practices in the U.S., but she works in these countries that are not as well off as we are, and she probably has to use a lot of compassion with these guys. So let's bring her out.
Yeah. So today we're going to be chatting with Amanda Hedman. She's worked for the last 14 years as an RVT in Cary, North Carolina. For the last 7 years, Amanda has traveled internationally for an organization called World Vets, providing medical care to small, large, and exotic animals all over the world. We're going to talk to her a lot about that because that's a really interesting idea and probably a lot of people in our field that want to get involved in something like that. Most recently started her own training relief veterinary technician business called Black Sheep Training. She holds an associate's degree in veterinary technology, a bachelor's degree in criminal justice, and completed a master of public health focusing on veterinary medicine. And in 2018 was presented the Technician of the Year by the North Carolina Association of Veterinary Technicians. Has a strong interest in ECC, ER, anesthesia, and certified as a recover instructor in 2019. So, Amanda, thank you so much for coming by the Vet Tech Cafe. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to have a seat at the table and talk with you guys.
Yeah. And first question, of course. So here at Vet Tech Cafe, we want to get you a cup of coffee. How do you take your coffee, or what are you drinking right now?
I actually stopped at Starbucks and picked up perhaps what I think is the best drink that they possibly have, which is the smoked butterscotch latte. And the reason why that's like the best is because that is very similar to a butterbeer latte that you would have, you know, if you were a big Harry Potter fan. And so that's actually what I have and what I'm drinking. It actually works out pretty well.
Well, we know you're a very big Harry Potter fan.
Yes, yes. I learned that in discussion before we got on the show today.
Yeah, so, I was actually surprised, Dave, that Jeff has said he's never watched a Harry Potter movie or read the book.
I haven't read the books, but I have seen snippets of one or two of the movies, but I haven't really watched a whole lot.
Oh, so disappointing.
Yeah, I was saying I'm like one of those people that was proud to have never seen an episode of Game of Thrones. I'm like probably just still stuck in that mindset, and I probably should just watch them. So, well, we'll get you that very specific cup of coffee. Very specific Harry Potter pot of coffee. Dave, what are you drinking? You drinking your black silk over there?
Black silk with a little bit of cream, a little bit of sugar.
Nice.
And what terrible coffee are you drinking tonight, Jeff?
I think you're going to like this one. So it's just black coffee, but the flavor in it is bourbon pecan.
All right. I can get behind that.
It's really good.
I can get behind that one.
Really, really.
Finally,
good.
What is this? So. What number episode is this? Like seven?
I think this is eight or nine.
Eight or nine episodes, and finally you're drinking something that I approve of. Excellent.
Well, I mean, that's also like a southern flavor. That's a pretty popular flavor down here in the South.
Nice.
That bourbon pecan, they like to put it in a lot of different things.
Excellent.
It's really good stuff.
All right, so Amanda, you have we were reading through your CV today, and it's very storied and very, very lengthy. So can you just describe your career path to how you got to where you are today?
I actually have a pretty unusual career path. I didn't start out in this field at all. Back when I was young and in college, I had this idea that I would perhaps be working in the criminal justice field, and I kind of had this weird idea that I might be a police officer working with the canine unit. So my degree is in criminal justice, and I have a focus on counseling juvenile delinquents. But that didn't really happen for me when I got out of college. I wasn't sure actually I wanted to be a police officer, and so I actually started working for some different agencies in our area that worked with kids that needed assistance. They had some kind of a problem either in their family or with the criminal justice system. And so I worked on counseling. Really, these kids like aged anywhere from like 12 to 17. And then after I did that part of the job, I was a rape crisis counselor and a sexual abuse advocate for many of the victims that went through the criminal justice system. So I would be there for them to make sure that they were okay as they went through this, you know, terrible thing that happened to them. The counseling part of that was something that has always been something that I think is super important, because people need help and they need assistance and they don't know really where to turn. And so being able to kind of fulfill that need was something that I really liked doing. But that was sort of where my career path was going, was continuing working in the criminal justice field. And life happened and I met a boy, got married. And after some serious thought, decided that I didn't necessarily want to continue that kind of path. What else can I do? And so I wasn't really sure. Talked to some different people. My husband was like, hey, Penn's here. What about vet school? I mean, I've been like the little girl that always likes animals, right? Everyone has that. You like dogs and cats and you bring home snakes and frogs and your mom's like screeching at you to get the frog out of the house. And you're like the little girl that loves horses. And so I never really thought about working in that field, but knew that I had a love for animals. And so kind of looked into that. Wasn't real happy about having to go, you know, do some more prerequisites, because that organic chemistry and calculus, like, that is terrible.
Ugh. Terrible.
I don't know anyone that loves that, but there's obviously someone. And so I was like, I don't think vet school is kind of my path. But then I randomly met some people, and one of the girls was working at a specialty practice in Philadelphia. And she said that I'm a credentialed veterinary technician. And I didn't know anything about that. I was like, what is that? Like, is that even a thing? Like, I did not know that there was people trained. I just thought it was all veterinarians. It was all doctors. I didn't know that there was something else. And so I went to work with her to sort of see what it was all about. It happened to be the best Friday night ever. Emergencies coming in the door left and right. Lots of blood. Lots of critical things happening. Lots of clients in the front lobby hysterical because their pet's been hit by a car. And I was like, this is it. Like, this is it. Like, this is what I want to do. And so I was like, I can't stop. And I think that night they like had to kick me out. And I was just holding things, helping things, getting stuff for her. Had no hands on at all. But it was like I was watching this like TV show and I thought, this is great. Like, this is what I want to do. Luckily, in the Philadelphia area, they have time. They had two really fantastic veterinary technician colleges. I kind of went to both, saw what was the best fit, ended up going to Manor College, spent the 2.5 years there. It was really great, like did all the veterinary technology classes, was super ecstatic about everything. And then my husband, he's in the military and he was changing locations. And so I was time for to do my externship. And the option was either North Carolina or Colorado. I grew up in upstate New York where there's like tons of snow, blizzard. You go outside to walk to the school bus and you're wearing like a snowsuit from that kid from the Christmas Story. Like, so I was like, I had enough of this. So let's go to North Carolina. And it happened to be perfect because it happened to be that Colorado had just had some terrible snowstorm and it had like locked down the state for a good like, you know, 2, 3, 4 days. And I was like, nope. Chris, we're going to North Carolina. And so came down here and I did my externship at a pretty fantastic specialty practice. And I'm still there 14.5 years later, although my role has changed, but I loved it. And I was very lucky that leadership sort of saw that I don't really fit into a box. Like, I'm not someone that you have to do this, like you have to be this, like I have to be looked at as an individual and try to figure out what best fits me and where my skills are best utilized. And so at that time, they had me work in all the different services and trained in oncology and medicine. At the end of that time period, they sat down and said, like, what do you like? And I was like, anesthesia is it. Like, I am obsessed with anesthesia. And I cannot ever get away from emergency and critical care. Like, these are the two places that I would excel at and I want to learn and I just want to like absorb everything I possibly can. They kind of created a position for me where I could work in both services, which was pretty unique at the time because they didn't really have anyone that did something like that. I just blossomed. It was really perfect for me. I was surrounded by a variety of doctors and technicians that all were incredibly supportive and wanted the best for me, wanted to teach me, and they really expect their technicians to be at a high level to understand why they're doing something and be able to be like their doctor's, you know, right hand. And so that's really how I started, was specialty medicine. I've never really worked in general practice, but specialty medicine has been really fantastic. I know it's not for everyone. I know anesthesia is not for everyone. Like, some people, I have friends that are scared to death of it, won't even sedate something, like, no, get someone else. But then I have friends that are scared to death of emergency too. Like, I had a friend come to just also shadow me, and it happened to be a crazy night, and she saw all this craziness and was like, no, this is not doing this. That's really what I did, and I worked probably the first 7.5 years in both services, really like coming up and learning things. And like I said, I had this great support system there. And then, as husbands do, he retired from the military and he moved overseas to the Middle East. And I thought, well, I'm going to have to go visit him. So I'm going to have to perhaps like leave this job. So I regrettably put in my notice and said I would not be able to work, you know, because I needed to go back and forth to see my husband. And luckily they were like, yeah, that sounds like a good idea, Amanda. And so they kind of changed the role for me there and just put me as a relief technician. So when I came back into town, I would pick up shifts and work, you know, tons of hours and then leave town again. And they would take me off the schedule. And so they have been really supportive over the last 14.5 years of allowing me to do things like this while I get to go out and do these crazy things.
Amanda, from what I remember, you still live like right next door to the hospital, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. So that's the other thing is that I live like a 5-minute walk from the hospital. Like, at any time, they will text me sometimes and say, like, we really need someone to come help and do this, or there's something here that needs a central line. Could you come over? And I always say yes, which I have to learn to say no, but I can't, right? Because I live right next door. So it's, I want to help, and I want to help the animals, and I want to help my team. And so they have been incredibly supportive of me over the last 14 and a half years. I'm very loyal, so I, of course, would always help. I went to see my husband in the Middle East, quickly realized that I'm not the type of girl to sit around and do nothing. I found a British veterinary clinic that was open in this Middle Eastern country and started to work for them. Pretty interesting place. Like, it's my first experience in working in a country where you can't get certain drugs, where animals are considered not pets. You know, they're considered just livestock, or like they don't have the same belief system. And so that was an eye-opening experience for me. I sort of was like, I think I want to do something different, because that was when I started to realize that there was a lot of need with different countries, especially developing countries, that people are just struggling to take care of themselves and their family, and they just don't have extra money to take care of their animals. So I wanted to do something, and I kind of was looking to do something. My husband had seen like a commercial at work on a military base, and the military has these civil humanitarian mission trips. You may have seen like the big white hospital ships that is the Navy and the Coast Guard have, and they go out to different countries that have natural disasters. It's this fantastic, basically, hospital on the ocean. They go to different countries that need help, and they provide amazing medical care for people that don't have it in their country, or they need the help because of a disaster. And of course, on board that ship is a veterinary team, because animals are part of it. The One Health movement is super important. Like, animals and people and the environment all together are affecting each other. And so there's a veterinary team, the military veterinary team that goes on those ships, and they were looking for civilian veterinary technicians to go and be a part of it. I'm like, this is going to be amazing. So I remember like looking online for it, and the NGO or the non-governmental organization that works with the military is called World Vets, and they were taking applications for this, and I applied and was like, you know, please call me. Like, never before wanted something so bad. And I remember getting the phone call, and they asked me a couple questions, and the questions were things like, are you able to take orders? Are you able to follow military rule? Do you understand the concept of hurry up and wait? Do you understand, like, and I'm like, yeah, I'm a military wife.
Yeah, that's ER.
I'm from a military family. Like, my dad's military, my uncles are, yes. And so it was perfect. The next thing I knew, I was on like this little plane flying through New Zealand into the South Pacific, this little island called New Caledonia. At that time, the big white hospital ship had to be dry docked. There was a problem. And so they had sent actually like a wartime ship. It was the USS Pearl Harbor out of Hawaii. So it was a regular working active duty military ship.
Wow.
It wasn't the hospital ship. And that's where they had the civilians embedded with the military.
Dang.
And it was fantastic. And that lots of people from different countries worked on these little tiny islands doing anything from spay and neuter to wellness checks for animals to basic husbandry. Many of the trip was on educating people how to take care of their animals, because in those little tiny islands, they don't necessarily have veterinarians or an equivalent veterinary technician, but they have paravet. And the paravets are people that kind of are who people go to for help when their animals need something. And so we do spend a lot of time with these people, like showing them about disease. And, you know, people in these countries depend on like their pigs or their sheep or their cows or their horses to do work. And so you would go into these countries and see like horses that would have to go like 10 miles to town to get water, to bring the water back to people's communities to sell it. And the horses had like overgrown feet. And so then they were lame. So just showing how to take care of doing basic hoof work and teeth work. And that effect, that's an immediate effect that you see. Like, the horse is better. The people can still continue to like use the horse's work. And so that sort of like started this whole thought process in my head of, there is way more out there that I can do. I can do something. Like, I can give back and use what I know to help other people and their animals and their community to make it better. I've gone on 3 military mission trips. I've stayed on, I said, like the USS Pearl Harbor. I was the big hospital ship, the Comfort. Recently in the summer, I was on a land mission trip in Guyana in South America. And then that sort of progressed into going on these trips all over the world with World Vets, doing these high volume spay neuter clinics. That itself is also pretty interesting and a great thing that has actually made me a better technician, because I've learned how to MacGyver things pretty greatly. When you're in these little countries and you can't get the right kind of drugs, or you don't have the supplies that you need, and you're trying to figure out how to still give the best quality care you can, you figure out pretty quickly how to do different things and what can work. And so that's just made me even better, especially when I come back and work, you know, at my specialty hospital, because things are not that exciting anymore. Like, oh my gosh, we don't have any 18 gauge catheters. Like, we can figure it out, guys. Like, things don't get me that excited as much anymore at all. Part of those trips is they have a training center that originally was in Nicaragua, where veterinary students come and learn spay and neuter techniques. So they learn the surgery skills and the anesthesia skills. And then vet tech students and pre-vet students learn catheter induction, physical exam, like your basic skills for animals. And so I've been teaching in that program, gosh, for like the last 4 or 5 years.
And is that through World Vets, or is that?
Yeah, that's also through World Vets. And I love that. And then that kind of progressed into, I started teaching at a veterinary technician program here in the Raleigh area. And I love teaching. I love figuring out how to get people excited to learn, and how they want to learn, and how they can learn, because people learn different ways. Like either
through,
you know, like through PowerPoint, through standing, through doing something. And so I easily can assess like if something's working or not working, and then pivot accordingly. So I love that teaching part of it.
That's also the emergency mentality of this isn't working, so we're going to do something a little different right now.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. No, it's great. Yeah. And I think that all of those things like combine into making me better. I oftentimes say like anesthesia is my husband and emergency and critical care is my boyfriend, and I have to have them both. I have to. Like, I love them both equally.
Nice. So so this World Vets, so is this something like, I think one of the big things globally that's going on right now that a lot of people are feeling the effects of is the wildfire situation in Australia. Yes. Is that something World Vets would go and help, you know, the animals?
So
like
actually that? Yeah, so part of World Vets is they have a wide range of volunteers from all over the world. And one of my friends is actually an Australian veterinarian, and he's in Sydney. And he right now is on, there's a team of World Vets that has sent supplies. And he's actually right now working with the different animals, large animals, you know, the exotic animals, the wildlife that is having an issue right now with the fires.
Oh, wow.
That's great.
So they
That's
do. Awesome. So they will send out different teams depending on where, you know, it just so happens that he already lives there. And so it was quite easy to kind of immobilize him and go. And so they send supplies, they send people, like so they're doing things like that. It just depends on who's around and what they can do.
Wow. Okay. When you go to these places, like how long are you often deployed for, if you will, like how long, you know?
Sure. So when you do the military mission trips, you're often there for weeks, like 4 to 6 weeks.
Okay.
Sometimes if it's a land position then or land volunteer, you're just there for a couple weeks. World Vets has many different trips that go all over the world. And so the high volume spay neuter clinics are usually about a week, 10 days. And you can go on the website and see the varieties that they have. And then also,
and what's that website real quick? We'll put it on our link, but yeah, on our page. Probably worldvets.org or something.
I think it's worldvets.org.
Yeah, we'll find it. We'll find it.
We'll link it.
And people can see what they can sign up for. And then the education part of it, like the training center, I just was in Peru for the last three and a half weeks, and they had a 2-week winter session where two different groups came in and learned, like I said, spay neuter techniques, anesthesia, induction catheter, basic care. And then they also have that same program in the spring. And then they have that same program that runs for like 8 weeks in the summer. And okay. So it just sort of depends on what I can and cannot do and what I'm doing. I like to say yes to everything, but of course, I can't say yes to everything.
So to some degree, you can kind of pick and choose, you know, what you want to do or how much you want to do it or that kind of thing.
Yeah, and so it has worked out really well because I can figure out like where I want to be. Like I recently have said, okay, I'm going to come back and be in town for a good solid 4 or 5 months, take a break and just work in my specialty hospital and then go do some training at some other specialty hospitals and then go teach here. And then everyone that has said yesterday I worked, everyone said to me, Amanda, that's going to last for about 6 weeks. And then you're going to say, I need to go somewhere.
Yeah.
It just sort of works out. I plan accordingly. Now that I've also started this consultant business where I go into different clinics and I train and teach their staff, either emergency, critical care, or anesthesia, I can kind of plan what I'm doing. And then I also can do these like relief or locum positions. And so I contract out to different companies or different veterinary hospitals to do that. And some I have that are kind of long-term. I'll go one place for the last 2 weeks of every month for like the next 3 weeks or next 3 months or... And so I can kind of pick and choose what I'm doing. And so when I have a chunk of time, I just kind of hop over to World Vets and say, like, what's happening? Like, what can I do? And kind of go from there.
Hmm. So one more question about World Vets before we move on to your teaching and your training business. What has been your favorite place to visit with World Vets and why?
So I think that's a really hard question to answer because every place that I've gone, first of all, I love to travel. Like I...
Clearly.
You could...
you well, must to do that.
Yeah, I love to travel. As a matter of fact, last year my passport ran out. And I think they're good for 10 years. Mine ran out at 5-year mark. And so when I got a new passport, they made me get like this extended version that has like an extra 25 pages because said I used it too quickly. And so I love this idea of like not really knowing what's happening. I like putting myself in these uncomfortable positions and seeing how I react. So it's nothing for me to like be dropped in India and I'm staying in some weird hotel. I like stuff like that. I like being able to go and see like each country kind of has a different cultural expectation about animals as well. So I like learning these things. And
sure.
I would have to say that Cambodia and Laos are very cool places to visit. I think
those
are really well. Cambodia has like it's sort of like the Wild Wild West. Like it's kind of crazy. Like things are happening, popping off at every street. You don't really know what's going on. The animals, oftentimes the monks take care of them. They have these different pavilions where all these animals are kind of there, and the monks are like really great expats that are living there, take care of animals, and so they're taken care of really well, and they have a really just they believe in the spirit of the animal, and so they have a really great belief about wanting to take care of them. So I like that a lot. I like working with the monks because I think it's super interesting. One monk I can say hello to, but the other one I can't because he's not at the right time in his path. And so I like learning all that sort of thing. Central and South America, like I love those countries. Peru is like the newest trip, and where you go for that is Cusco. And Cusco itself is like a great little town. You can like go and do like the volunteer veterinary work and then jump off and go to Machu Picchu or go off and do some pretty great hikes. And so those places are really great. And I talk about this like it's no big deal, right? Like, oh, just go to Peru and do veterinary work.
Yeah, you make it sound so easy.
It sounds so easy, right? But, I mean, there is cost involved, and so people will save up for these trips, or they oftentimes fundraise for these trips. There's many different places that do these kinds of trips. And if you can't go out of the United States, a place that's in the United States that does these trips is called RAVS. It's like a Rural Area Veterinary Services, and they send volunteer veterinary groups onto different Native American reservations out like in Arizona and in the Dakotas. Mm-hmm. And those are great trips as well because there's a huge need for veterinary care on reservations. There's a lot of stray dogs and they have a lot of, when I was in Arizona in the fall and parvo was huge. Like many animals had parvo. And so they have a big need for things right here in the United States, as well as like even like local places. Like if you couldn't even like leave your area, there's plenty of spay neuter trap release programs through your SPCA or your shelters, so they would always appreciate help from a credentialed veterinary technician.
And when you get to some of these places, it probably depends on maybe what the mission of the trip is, but as a veterinary technician, what is your role? If you think back on a couple of these trips, like what do you specifically do?
No surprise, part of my role is always training and teaching. And the part of the trips that I love the best is when we are working with a local organization that puts vet students from that country or the equivalent of a vet tech from that country and puts them with our group working with us because they're learning skills that they don't know that is going to have an immediate effect and when they go back to their practice or when they go back to school. I was in Brazil and they had vet students and the equivalent of a vet tech. And I was like teaching how to place catheters. How do you give sub-Q fluids? These are all things that they did not know. They would have learned, but perhaps they learned it a different way from me. Like, I still get messages. I always make these like fake little legs that I take with me. Like, so I can, when I'm teaching catheter placement, I usually give it to the person. And I still get messages from some of these vet students from Brazil, and they still have their fake leg. they're practicing their catheter, and like, those things are sustainable, right? They have media effect. They're going to change lives. They're potentially going to save animals' lives if they need a catheter fast, you know? And so I very much enjoy the training part. And I think those parts of the trip are really great. On any of those trips, like depending on kind of where you're placed, could be doing anesthesia monitoring. And so people oftentimes don't know how to do TEVA or like the total intravenous anesthesia. And so oftentimes on these high volume spay neuter trips, that's how animals are. There's no gas anesthesia, like there's no oxygen. And so you're learning how to perhaps push ketamine Valium as needed for them to get through the surgery. And some of these countries don't have great pain drugs. So you're figuring out what they have and what you can use. And so you're monitoring, you know, in my specialty hospital, I have gold standard, right? I have the best of the best at everything. Oftentimes in these countries, all I have is myself and my stethoscope.
Yeah, which really for a veterinary technician, honestly,
is the best thing.
That's all you need. Like a good technician with their hands, their ears, their eyes, and a stethoscope.
Yeah, and I think that is such an important thing to do. And I was laughing a little bit. I was thinking about, Dave, you teaching over at the tech school. Yeah. And one of the things that I would do during the anesthesia lab is turn off everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep.
And make them just monitor with themselves and their stethoscope.
Yeah.
And the look of fear
on
their face is horrifying.
Yeah.
But it's the best thing you can learn because that's what's important. Like, you're the best monitor. And so that has only made me better. And I think so there's a little bit of a learning curve.
Yeah,
there's a little bit of that look of horror as well.
I bet.
That happens.
I bet.
But I cannot even think of any technician that has come on a trip that hasn't been happy to do that and learn that. And it has helped them when they go back to their regular practice because they're not as reliant on the machines and they have a better sense of what they're looking for.
I always tell my students that those machines are great. They're there to help you. They are not there to be you.
Right.
So Amanda,
real quick, Dave, I can't help but think, but you know, with Amanda having been all over the world, maybe that's where some of our international downloads are coming from.
Have you been
wherever Amanda goes? We've got a little place on the map she downloads.
We'll have to look back to your travel plans and see how many of those are you.
Well, I share, like, I am such a nerd. Like, in my spare bedroom, like half of my bedroom is this whole setup with like books and documents and journals and a table and like notes and another computer and trying to learn like tons of stuff and relearn stuff. And like something happened and I'm like, what was that? I go home and I like review everything. And then
go home and relax.
Yeah. But I was so excited that you started this podcast. And so I've been sharing it with lots of people. So absolutely it could have like come from different places.
It's entirely possible that you're the reason for our international listeners.
No, I don't think I'm the only reason for sure. You guys have much more fans than just me. Like, absolutely. Yeah. So the technicians, they'll do like that. They'll learn catheter placement. That's small animal day, right?
Yeah.
And large animal day, which is the best day. You usually go out into the community and people will bring their animals. And so you'll do wellness checks and you learn about lots of strange diseases that they have in these countries. And they'll bring their cows and their sheep and their goats and their donkeys and chickens for you to do work on. And so this is always my favorite part because I very much like to educate wherever I'm doing things like this. And there's kind of a great picture of me and I'm surrounded by all these little boys and I'm showing them how to like properly feed the donkey grass because they're all doing it and getting nipped. And I'm like, no, flat hands. And so I like those sort of things. I think those are important. I think it makes better technicians, better doctors to come and have these types of experiences.
And Amanda, kind of touching back on what Jeff and I were talking about in the beginning of the episode, compassion fatigue, going to all these countries with lesser privileged people and lesser privileged animals, do you ever run into compassion fatigue or can you just talk about that a little bit?
Sure. So I have had a terrible example of that kind of happened. We did a lot of great work in India with a lot of like the street dogs. Rabies is still a issue there, and so people are afraid of the dogs, and so being able to pick the dogs up, get them rabies vaccinated, get them spayed and neutered, try to like help them is super important. They also believe the cows, right, are holy in India.
Right.
There are many organizations that will take care of cows that have been hit by cars or hit by trucks or something has happened to them. And they are doing the best care that they can. And one of the gifts that we can give animals is euthanasia. When you're working in countries where they don't believe in euthanasia, you know, I saw some dogs that had some really terrible injuries. And again, just euthanasia is not an option.
Right.
And I understand, like, I absolutely understand their religious and cultural preference, but sometimes you just have to accept it. You can do what you can for those animals, but ultimately this, like, you're in their country, you do what they want. And so sometimes when those things happen inside, I have to take a minute because I'm like, wow, I just, okay, all right, let's figure out what we can do. And like, it kind of move forward. So I think that's sort of sometimes a hard thing to see. And I, perhaps that could be one of the things that when people are going on these international voluntary veterinary trips, when they see things like that, that's sometimes very hard for people.
Yeah, I bet.
Oof.
But it's just sometimes hard. The country's religious and cultural beliefs differ so much from ours, you know?
Right,
but,
yeah. And you have to kind of adapt to what they want you to do.
And it's like, not like oftentimes, like my supervisor will be somewhere and like we're talking with like a veterinary team from that country, and he'll be like, hey, Amanda, how much would it cost to fix this dog's broken leg at your specialty clinic in the, you know, in the U.S.? And I'm like, an emergency? Because then there's an anesthesia emergency.
Right.
And so, I'm like, I give them a number, like 25 to 35, and they're just like, what? And so people are just shocked at, like, you know, in the U.S., what we pay for our animals.
Yeah.
But it's, again, a different cultural thing that we do here in the U.S. And so they always get a big kick out of that.
Amanda, your company, Black Sheep.
Yeah, Black Sheep Teaching.
So why did you pick that name?
You'll probably laugh at this, but at the college, they have your license up on the wall, which I'm sure yours is up there
yep,
as well.
Yep, it is.
And everyone's was in color, and mine was in black and white. And I remember being there, like, in the faculty room, sort of being like, why is mine in black and white? Like, what am I, the black sheep? Like, you couldn't color it?
Got
you couldn't
it.
Print it out in color?
Got it.
And it kind of became a joke. And I teach very differently. Like, I'm not your average teacher or trainer. Like, I just don't stand there and read off a PowerPoint differently.
Right.
And I pivot a lot, and I talk a lot about how things are in real life and how things work in the specialty hospital, how things could work in a general practice, how things work in, you know, the field. And so I teach really differently. So the biggest part of my job as an educator is to get people excited and motivated.
Well, and it's like David Liss said, if you're not entertaining, get off the stage, man.
Yeah. And I'm pretty entertaining, like I will say that. And so it sort of became this joke that I was like the black sheep instructor of the faculty because, you know, students would love to come to my class and why are they learning so well in your class? And so it just sort of became a joke that I was like the black sheep. And then I kind of was like, wait a minute, I kind of like that. And that's sort of where that name came from. And I just sort of stuck. But it is sort of a funny story that it all
It's funny
from.
How that stuck with
it. Yeah.
Yeah. Just printing great. Out my license on black and white.
That's great. So describe like what you do for Black Sheep Teaching.
Sure.
So are you going into clinics and like, you know, just providing training, that kind of thing?
So it kind of started because I have to say that I was very lucky to have a wonderful support system. And I have great parents and I have a great husband that are very supportive of me doing all these crazy things. But I also have sort of surrounded myself with a variety of people from different specialties and from different kind of locations that want to see me succeed and want to see me do well, you know, push me to be great as well as call me out when I'm doing something really stupid. Kind of all came to a pass, like specialty clinic would send me out to different general practices in the area to teach things. And so I started doing that. And then I started doing that on my own because I would meet all these people. I network continuously. I hustle a lot. And so I meet lots of people and just sort of start talking about what I can do for them. And then I start getting messages like, hey, could you come to our clinic and do this? Could you come and just train the staff? They're having a hard time with this particular topic. I thought there was something to it, but I wasn't really sure if I would be accepted, right? Like, I don't have a VTS.
Sure,
you know,
sure.
I didn't know, like, do I really have enough to offer? Am I good enough? You know, like I wasn't really sure. And so
that kind of almost imposter syndrome.
Yeah. And it is imposter syndrome is completely a thing. And
you don't got to tell
absolutely.
Us.
It happens and you don't even know what happens. So that story sort of happened where I was at Cornell and I was at the Recover instructor, the deep dive they do up there, which is fantastic to become a CPR instructor. And I was sitting at the table and I was worried because before I went, I recognized that there was many VTSs there and maybe me and another girl were not. And I was like, am I allowed to do this? Like, I'm not sure. And I remember like Ken being like, no, like you can totally do this. And all of these people were so supportive and started like asking me like what I'm doing. And were like, you're doing what we're doing, Amanda. Why don't you have your own business? And I'm like, what, is that a thing? Like, can I do that? And they're like, yes, what are you doing? Like, you're doing this for your clinic and you're doing things on your own. It was that sort of when the idea kind of started to process. Still wasn't sure. And then it just sort of things happened kind of quickly because the more you network, the more people recognize you and know what you can do. And I started getting emails from different hospitals saying like, hey, could you come and do this? I was like, I guess I can. And then I was like, I guess I'm going to have a business. I guess I'm going to have a business. And so I started this like LLC and it happens, right? Like I get these calls and sometimes it's for, hey, could you come and do locum work? Hey, could you come do relief work? That happens maybe like 25% of the time. The other 75% of the time is like, hey, can you come and work with our staff and train them? And those types of things, I'll go to like the hospital. I sort of am on the floor. I'm talking to different team members, trying to understand what's going on. And I can kind of assess like what's going on. And then I speak with the leaders. And sometimes it's really good to get an impartial, like what's happening. Like they may know what's happening, but they don't really want to accept it.
Right.
You know what I mean? And so when you come in and you like work with people and you can then say, well, this is what I saw and they really need this. Then they're like, oh, okay. And so I really like doing that. And usually the first night or the first day that I'm in a hospital, everyone's worried to talk to me. They're like, you're going to tell everything. You're here to spy on us.
Yeah.
And I'm like, no, that's not at all. I want to make it better for you. Like I want everyone to work together as a team and I want people to want to come to work, right? You have to work your whole life. You want to go somewhere that you feel like you're an important member of the team, somewhere that supports you and wants you to get better and do better. What can I do to help you guys with this? That is part of the job as well. I do that in skill assessments, like, or how to help people learn different skills. Sometimes it's more of the advanced skills. The technicians don't know how to play central lines. They haven't really had the opportunity. And so they'll like ask me to come and like show those sort of things. But usually what happens is contacted, we talk about what they're looking for. I ask kind of like, what are the goals of what you need? And then I kind of move from there. I'll be honest with you. Sometimes they don't really want to hear what I have to say, right?
Sure.
I mean, they want me to say everything's great and that they're doing a great job. I mean, what's really important is the staff.
Yeah.
I want the
the reason you're there is because that's not really what's going on.
Yeah. I want the technicians to be happy and want to be there and be working in a team. And so sometimes they don't really like what I have to say. But usually that I know that has happened when it's taken a couple of days for them to. So what happens is I usually have a meeting at the end, then I leave, and then I kind of put together a report. And I usually put together like, you know, a document with like photos and references, and I reference journals, or I reference this is why I think this, or and I show different things. And so when I know that it's sort of like, we have to let this kind of like marinate for a little bit is when no one messages me back for a couple days. Like I know that they're sort of like, what? Then, you know, I haven't ever had a hospital not message me back to say, okay, let's talk more about what you can do. But there has been times where they don't really want to hear it. But you know, I bet. A lot of money for me to come in. So
yeah.
I mean, what do you want? You know, so I really like that. I really like the training and the teaching part of it. Whatever I can do to help, I really want that because so many people have helped me. And that's really important to give back to newer people that are just starting their careers in this veterinary field. Because you talked about with compassion fatigue and burnout, you want people to want to be in it.
Yeah.
Not just in it for like 2-3 years and then get out because they're so upset or they don't feel like they're being taken care of. So I think it's important that we give back to like people that are up and coming, like this new group that want to learn, because the worst thing you can do is just sort of squash the light out of someone, right? That's Amen. Terrible.
Yeah, for sure.
And I don't want that to happen.
For sure. So how can a clinic get in touch with Black Sheep Teaching if they're interested in having you come in?
It's just a matter of either contacting me directly through like my personal email. I'm in the process now of getting like a website up. But,
oh, cool. Great. Okay.
So that's really the way to do it. And I mean, I'll tell you that there's enough out there that many people could be doing what I'm doing.
Sure.
There are plenty of places that need experienced, credentialed technicians that have a wide range of skills, that it doesn't have to be anesthesia or emergency critical care. It could be someone that's really great in internal medicine and they need that person, or someone that's really great in dentistry or oncology. Like it doesn't have to be these two things. It just turns out that these are two things that I get called for a lot.
Well, it also seems like this type of business is something that's up and coming, because if you think about it, 10 years ago, I'd never heard of a veterinary technician consulting business or a training business.
Right.
I think we talked to Liza last episode and she does that.
Yeah.
You know, and
if you're in any sort of, not even major metropolitan area, but anywhere that there's 50,000 people, there's going to be dozens of clinics and at least, you know, some locally that are going to be looking for some help. And so, yeah, absolutely.
Oh, and there's
very much an untapped resource.
I mean, I just was on a trip with another technician and she has a business where she places people. She's not placing herself or doing training herself. And technicians are, you know, doing that and organizing those types of businesses as well.
Yeah.
So I agree with you. Like, this is an up and coming thing. And as long as you can back up what you're doing.
Right.
Yeah.
Then you can do it through just like, you know, my experience and the different advanced training I have taken. Like, I took this amazing 1-year class through VetBloom. It was the advanced anesthesia class, and it was the hardest thing I've ever done. It was 4 modules and you're tested on an amazing amount of information, and I was surrounded by, again, like brilliant technicians that just wanted to learn as much about anesthesia as they can. And I have that, when people have that hunger to want to learn, opportunities open up for them.
Yeah, for sure.
And that was through VetBloom, right? Is that correct?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was through VetBloom.
We can post that on the...
Yeah, we'll put that in the notes too, a link to that.
Yeah, I would say that if people that are super interested in anesthesia and want to be taught by some amazing anesthesiologists and criticalists and VTSs, that is a fantastic class. That is well worth the money. It is well worth the time. Well worth the tears. But that also is a great class. That, you know, the CPR, the recover classes are fantastic. I can't even, like, I know, I think you guys both just did that, right? The instructor.
I have not done the instructor.
Yeah, yet. I did it this past IVEX.
You know, I think that those things are great. The Recover, that online program for people to take online, the BLS and ALS, those are fantastic ways for people to learn. If you want to learn, there's a plenty of stuff, and that just helps you become more well-rounded and a better technician. Another avenue that is super important as well is like leadership training and learning how to have effective communication with others, especially with the, like, a generational gap. That's sort of like a new thing, right? The millennials and learning how to motivate and encourage different age groups. So all these things are out there. And once you start finding them and doing them, it just opens you up to be a better professionally and better personally.
Absolutely.
That's great. So, Amanda, we're about out of time today.
Okay.
It was great talking to you. You gave us a lot of great information about World Vets and about your training practice. These things have been great. And I think it's going to be really helpful for our listeners. So we'd like to finish up all of our episodes with a random non-veterinary question that you don't know about.
Oh, I'm scared.
Don't be that scared. This one's more of an opinion question. You ready?
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on garden gnomes?
Oh, they're creepy.
So you don't have any?
No, I don't have any. They're absolutely creepy. And I think that all those things that people put in their gardens are creepy. Like the flamingos. The worst is the cutouts of like the people bending over. Have you seen those? Terrible. Like, I don't know what people are thinking. Just leave your gardens alone, people. Flowers, landscaping, vegetables. That's it. None of this other stuff.
No garden gnomes. Duly noted.
on my drive to work, just maybe 10 minutes from our apartment, I go by a house and it's like a corner lot, and they have like a hill at the end of their house, and some brush and some low shrubs and stuff. And in and amongst that is a wooden Sasquatch with the face cut out. So like you can literally like just walk up and put your face in Sasquatch. But I'm like, what, what is this doing? Now
that sounds creepy.
I will say that that is a little bit creepy. I personally love Sasquatches and Bigfoots. Like, they're out there.
So those might be okay in a garden.
But then. I would not put that in a garden. That is not where they belong. But that is a very strange thing to have in your garden, this, like, cutout thing. It's almost like they took it from, like, a fair or
yeah,
a carnival.
It looks exactly like that. But I'll tell you, when you drive by it at night and your headlights hit it and you're not really expecting it, it's something else.
That's
crazy.
Yeah. So no to garden gnomes.
No to garden gnomes.
They're running around at night doing bad stuff.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Amanda. This has been really great. We really appreciate you coming on the Vet Tech Cafe, and we thank you so much for coming on today.
Thank you so much. I actually have the World Vets website up. It is worldvets.org. There's some really, really cool stuff on here. Anybody that's remotely interested in this kind of work, like, definitely check it out. But thank you so much for telling us about it, because I know there's going to be a lot of people that want to do stuff like this and just don't know how to start.
Great.
Thank you so much.
That's wonderful. Thanks, guys.
All right. Have a good night, Amanda.
Have a good night, Amanda. And everybody, thank you for stopping by the Vet Tech Cafe. And we hope you enjoy the rest of your weekend. Anybody that's headed out to VMX this weekend, safe travels. Hopefully you don't hit any weather delays or anything. I hope you have some great lectures, some great labs, and enjoy the weekend. And we'll chat another time.
Okay.
Thanks, everybody. Dave and Jeff would like to thank you for listening to the Vet Tech Cafe podcast today. As we talk about difficult issues facing our profession and chat with colleagues who have strong opinions of those issues, we feel it is important to note that the opinions and views expressed by Dave, Jeff, or our guests on the Vet Tech Cafe podcast are solely theirs and theirs alone, and do not represent any other person, business, institution, or any other entity. If you have any questions relating to this, please email us at vettechcafe@gmail.com. Thanks again for stopping by the Vet Tech Cafe.